separate department called Two Queers, and I'll try to show the connection to a problem that has nothing to do with crypto or security, which is the identity testing for the F3 circuit. And this is junk work with Miloš Pirka, and the cartoon has nothing to do with the work. I just thought this crowd would appreciate it. But, okay, so I'll start with a quick explanation of the title. So what are these local decoder codes, and what is identity testing, what is the F3 circuits, and then I'll describe the results, which include improved law bounds for two query LDCs. The main result is how to get two LDC from identity zero depth three circuit. And combining these two results, we get a structural theorem for identity zero depth three circuits and a polynomial identity testing algorithm. So I'll explain all these things in a minute. Okay, so I'm not sure I need this slide, but let's do it anyway. So what is a locally decodable code? So it's some function E from F to the N to F to the M. And it's called the QLDC, or Q query locally decodable code, if a message symbol XK can be recovered from reading only Q entries of the code word, E of X, even if the code word is corrupted in some constant fraction of the coordinates. And think of Q as a very small number, a constant, two or three. And of course, you can only... What?
What is K?
K is an index between Y and N.
What's that?
What?
H.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so, and this of course happens only with some high probability, hopefully. And this is the visual definition. So this is X1 to Xn, this is the code word. And there's some decoding algorithm that takes K as an input, tosses some coins, chooses Q positions in the code word, and output XK with some, let's say, 90% possibility of success. So these codes are really nice things, really interesting objects. And the main questions are, first, how to construct them, and of course, we want to know that the constructions are the best possible, so we like to get a low bounce. And the main parameter is the length of the encoding, really interesting. So we fix Q, we look at Q equals 2, Q equals 3, and we want to know what is the best code, what is the best encoding length. So what are the known constructions for small Q? So the best construction until a few days ago was this one of Emily Shakespeare and Raymond. And so if you look only asymptotically, then this is still the best best construction. But of course, there's a new result of Sergei, which you'll hear about in 40 minutes, which shows that this is probably much, much lower than we thought it was.
So excuse me, how is the size of the view coming here?
It doesn't. Well, we'll talk about it in a minute. But here it doesn't, I'm not sure for what fields this works, but maybe we can ask. Okay, we'll see later that something related to the size of the field. So on the other direction, the low bounds are very difficult to prove. So the general low bound of for any Q is a low bound of Katzen-Trevisan of slightly superlinear low bound, and so the only case where we have really, really strong low bounds is for two query codes. So the first low bound was proven by Goldrath et al. For linear codes with two queries, and the low bound was exponential in n minus log f. F is the size, as if f is the field. And later, this bound was extended to nonlinear codes by Kalanithis and De Wolf for codes over 0, 1. And we'll hear about this plot tomorrow. Oh. And so work, we improved the bound of Kolder-Hakal to codes, linear two-query codes. We just what we do is we remove the dependence on the field size. So we show that the slow bound is exponential independent of the size of the field. So taking a larger field will not help you with a better code. And this result is a sort of an auxiliary result to the main result of the paper. We needed this to get our identity testing algorithm to work for any field. So we'll see later how it comes in. This is only over 0.1.
Oh, okay.
And it's not
linear.
Okay, so now I'll explain what is the polynomial identity testing. The basic problem is the following. You're given some polynomial f of x 1 to xn over some field, and you want to know if this is the identically zero polynomial. So we assume that f is given in some succinct representation. So if f is given just by a list of monomials, then this is not much fun, because you just see if it's zero or not. But if it's given by a circuit, then it's very hard to proceed. So how it depends on what kind of algorithm you use. But you want to know if this is zero, and this is very useful. If you can do this, you can do a lot of things, like formality testing and matching algorithms, and a lot of natural problems can be reduced to checking whether some circuit is zero or not. So of course, we all know that evaluating f of x over some random point taken from large enough field will be non-zero with very high probability if the field is chosen to be large enough. So probability of getting a zero is the degree divided by the size of the field. Okay, so this gives a very good solution in practice if you really need to check if the polynomial is zero. But we would like a deterministic algorithm. And the reasons are mostly theoretical, so there's not going to be any practical use for deterministic algorithms, but because it will probably take a lot of time. But theoretically, it's a very interesting and very hard. It's one of the central main problems in de-randomization. Because this is one of the most interesting problems, de-randomization. De-randomizing, this is a specific problem. It has a lot of implications. For example, lower bounds, which we'll see in the next slide. So this is in the long term, probably very long term, and for the short term, we can look at restricted models. So we could look at formulas, bounded depth circuits, and so on. Okay, so what is the situation for general circuits? So there are some algorithms that are more complicated than the Schwarz-Zippel algorithm, and but they all, even the best ones, they use a lot of random bits. They use n times log d over epsilon random bits. With this, the degree and epsilon is the probability of error.
Sorry, you talk about
multivariate
polynomials.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's also the problem also interesting for univariate, if the degree is exponential.
No, for univariate I understand, but for multivariate polynomials, multivariate polynomial is a circuit, right?
No, no, so the field is large and you want to know, or just any field, you want to know if the circuit is identically zero as an identity. So for example,
the
polynomial x to the q minus x is not the identically zero over fq.
It means all the monomials are zero.
You're not interested in the problem of whether the circuit computes the identity, the zero function over a field. This is NP complete for like small fields. It's GF2, it's satisfiability. But you're interested to see if the polynomial is zero, if all monomials cancel.
All monomials cancel.
This is why you can do it in a randomized polynomial time, because you can take an extension field. So a circuit is zero if and only if it's zero over the algebraic closure. So you can take the field as large as you want, and this is what allows you to do something. interesting result of Kabanem in Palazzo. This result is really amazing. It shows that if PAT is in P, so if there's a polynomial identity testing algorithm, which is deterministic, and runs in polynomial time, then you get the arithmetic low bounds for next. So it's a bit, it's a strange result, because it shows that if PAT is in P, then either next doesn't have polynomial size circuits, or the permanent doesn't have arithmetic polynomial size circuits. So you can think whatever you want about this result, but it shows some connection between these two problems. And of course, low bounds is like the holy grail of the body here. And on the other direction, they show how to use low bounds for arithmetic circuits. And they show that if the permanent doesn't have small arithmetic circuits, then they can use this to do randomized identity testing. They can use this to check if polynomial is zero or not. So there's a really, really nice connection between the low bounds and identity testing. And so this connection is formally proven only for general circuits, but even if you look at the restricted models, such as bounded depth circuits and so on, there's some connection which is not, we can't prove anything yet, but it seems like you need to really understand something about the model of computation to prove low bounds, and you also need to understand something to do identity testing. So this explains maybe the hardness of why we don't have a lot of deterministic identity testing results, because we don't understand circuits. Okay, so. But we can look for a PAT where there are low bounds. And there are not many places where there are low bounds, but there are some. So one example where this has happened is for non-commutative formulas. So these are the formulas where variables do not commute. So x1, x2 is not x2, x1. It's order. And so it's much harder to compute a polynomial in this model, because things don't cancel nicely. We need to really work to compute something. So there's a work of Nissan from 91 that gives exponential low bounds, and the new center, Raz and Spielke, found deterministic identity testing for this model. Another example is the depth 2 circuit, which is just another name for sparse polynomials. So these are circuits, you're given a circuit and you know that it computes polynomials with a small number of monomials. So there's a very nice algorithm for this model for identity testing, and Clivens and Spielman give deterministic polynomial time algorithm. So these are two examples, and for depth 3 circuits, there was nothing. And Clivens and Spielman ask whether it can be done for depth 3 circuits with the top fanning of the circuit is 3. And we'll see in the next slide how the circuit is built. So the fanning of the top gate is 2, this is a trivial problem, and for 3 it becomes non-trivial. You really need to understand something. But it's really, it's really embarrassing to ask this question. How can you not do this? It looks really easy, but it's not. So in this paper, we tackle this problem. So we look at depth 3 circuits where the top fanning is bounded by some constant. And so we give a deterministic quasi-polynomial time algorithm, the constant time n to the polylog. And it's going to be polynomial time if the circuit is also multilinear. Multilinear circuits are circuits where you don't multiply the variable with itself. And also we get a randomized polynomial time algorithm that uses only polylogarithmic number of random bits. So of course the first one follows from the second, not the other way. This is the result, and very recently, this was improved by Kayal and Saxena. They gave a polynomial time algorithm for the same model. So they also took a depth 3 circuit with bounded top fanning. But they use a completely different approach, and they not only show preliminary time algorithm, they also show limitations of our approach. So I have nothing to say about this, but you can imagine. No, it's really beautiful paper. But there's still some there's still something about what we do, which we show some things that don't follow from the algorithm. We'll see later what we show in this app. And they didn't have to prove a lower bound for locally decodable codes, which was this is why I'm here. Okay. So this is a depth to circuit. So the stop gate is an addition gate. Then we have k multiplication gates, and k is going to be bounded, going to be some different constant. And on the bottom gate we have addition gates, which compute linear functions. So we get the sum of products of linear functions. Some notations that use in a minute. So we call the linear functions Lij, bottom level, and we call Mi the product gates, so the polynomials computed by product gates. So this is the circuit six, the sum of products of linear functions. So they also call the sigma pi sigma k series. Sigma pi sigma is for this structure, and k is for the top of any. Okay, so I don't have a lot of time, so I'll just really quickly sketch the low bound for the tuple codes, just show the difference of what we change in the proof, which eliminates the dependence on the field size, and then we'll see other rest of the stuff. So, the low bound for tuple codes of Goldorf et al. Uses for field of size 2, it reduces to some problem over the hypercube. And the low bound is basically an isoparametric inequality. So we have set the subset of the hypercube, and we bound the number of edges in this set. And the proof for fields other than GF2 is obtained in the following way. You take a linear 2LDC over F, and you transform it to a linear 2LDC over 0, 1 of size F times N. So you pay a factor of F in the size of the encoding, and then you plug this into the original theorem, and you get this lower bound, which depends on the field size. And this transformation from F to 0, 1 is done by taking a random map from this large field to 0, 1, and showing that for some choice of this random mapping, this remains a good code. So what we do is we take the same approach, but we instead of taking all multiple. All multiples, and in the first proof, we take each code position and take all the multiples of this position. This is why the factor of f. So instead of doing this, we take only a well chosen multiple of each coordinate, and then we apply this random mapping, and we show that it remains a code with positive probability. Just I don't know if it's a good idea. Okay.
Should I go back? And you show that this map works high probability?
No, not just positive probability. So we take all the elements of the field that appear in the code and make each one of them to 0 or to 1 equal probability, and going to with some positive probabilities is going to give up a good code. And the parameters of the code are going to decrease by a factor of 2. It's not an explicit actually, this means that the low band was also over infinite fields. Wasn't looked at before. Okay, so I want to show how this is connected to identity testing for depth free circuits. So before we see that, we really have to look at the very easy case where the top fanning of the circuit is 2. And then when we move to top fanning 3, we'll see how this code's coming. For 2, this is really a problem because so we have this circuit which is the sum of products of linear functions. And we know that linear functions are irreducible polynomials. And since we know that every polynomial is can be uniquely written as a product of irreducible polynomials, we get that if C is 0, then M1 and M2 have the same factors. They have the same reducible factors. So it seems that there is some matching between these linear functions. And each pair is just a pair of linear functions that are constant multiple of each other. So this takes care of this case because you can just look for such a matching. And if we found it, we can rewrite the circuit as just a product of linear functions. It's very easy to see if it's 0 or not. And if we didn't find the matching, then it's not 0. So this is a trivial case. Now let's go on to the case when we have top fanning 3. And this is much more complicated, so now we need preliminaries. So the first thing we can assume is that linear functions are homogeneous. And this is just by adding add another variable and it will stay 0 or not 0. I won't describe it, but it's very, very easy. The second thing which is really useful is that we can take an invertible linear map of the variables and apply it. So we can look at C of X and we can look also at C of A of X, where A of X is a linear change, invertible linear change of variables. And the original circuit will be 0 if and only if the new circuit is 0. So it's invertible. And so we'll see in a minute how we use this, but first we need to define the rank of the circuit, which is really the central definition. So the rank of the circuit is just the rank of this family of linear functions that appear in C. So we take all linear functions in C and look at the dimension of the vector space that they span. And this definition will be our main tool. So we're going to show that if C is 0, and the rank is very small. And if the rank is small, we're going to it's going to make our life much easier.
What do we
think
linear functions
can see? Well, take all the linear functions computed at the bottom left. Without order, just a set of linear functions.
What were you called before L?
The L's. L, yeah, L-I-J's. Okay, so let's look at the following corollary from this claim and the definition. So if the circuit, if the rank of the circuit is R, we have some spanning set of size R with all linear functions that span all the linear functions in C, and we can use this invertible mapping A to transform them into linear functions x1 to xr. What happens is that all linear functions in the circuit now depends only on our variables after this transformation. So if the rank is small, actually we can work with the circuit with a very small number of variables, which is good because then we can write down all monomials. And so another corollary from the same argument, we see that these variables x1 to xr appear as linear functions in C. So we had this spanning set of linear functions and we move them to x1 to xr, so now we have x1 to xr here in the circuit in some of the places. Okay, so let's use all of this information to identity testing. So we have a circuit which is the sum of three products, and we know that x1 to xr are linear functions. And another thing we can assume is that the GCD of M1, M2, M3 is 1. If we have a GCD, create something dividing both M1, M2, and M3, then we can just get rid of it. Because it will be just some product of linear functions that appears in all gates. So this is something we can throw away. Okay, so we have this this thing. So we have this linear function divided into three groups. And we're going to look at this variable xs for some x. S is between 1 and r. And we're going to reduce this to the case of two multiplication gates by setting xx to 0. Okay, so this is the idea. We're going to look at the restriction of the circuit after xs is 0. And we know that if 0 is 0, then the restriction is 0. Okay, so set xs to 0. What happens now? You know that the sum of the two restricted polynomials M1 and M2 and M3 is 0 after the restriction. So using the information from the previous case, we know that there's a matching between the restricted linear functions. So each pair in this matching is a pair of proportional linear functions after the restriction of xs to 0. We do the same thing for xt, for another value between 1 and r, and we get another matching between linear functions in the first and second row. So we do this r times, and we get r matchings. And each matching, we have this information in each matching that there are pairs of linear functions that are proportional. Okay, so let's see what this means. What I'm going trying to show is that the set of linear functions is a tuple code, linear code, so this is the lemma we just hand waved the book. For every XS, there are D pairs, such that each pair is proportional after the restriction of XS to 0. So the final step is observing the following thing. So if you have these two linear functions, L1 and L2, and if you know that after the restriction of xs to 0, they are proportional, then they have to span xs. So we can compute xs from both of them. And the reason is that if it wasn't the case, then they would have to be proportional before the restriction. So if they were they weren't proportional before the restriction, and after the restriction they became proportional, then they have to span xs. And this would mean that we have some function, a linear function that divides both m1 and m2. And so if c was 0, then this linear function would have to divide also m3. And so we would have a non-trivial GCD, which is a contradiction. Okay, so now we can define this EX, which is just the concatenation of these linear functions. And this is going to be a tuple code, because for the S, there are D pairs, such that XS is spanned by these two code positions, corresponding to the pairs in the matching. So using the slow bound that we know about the codes, so E is a 2LDC of length 3D. And the message size, if you remember, is R, is the length of the circuit. So we get that the encoding 3D is exponential in the length. Or equivalently, we get that the rank is logarithmic in D. So the rank is very, very small, which is good. So if the circuit is 0, then the rank is small. And now we're very happy because we can see if this is zero, the circuit is zero very easily. We can just compute the rank. And if it's high, then we say it's not zero. And if it's small, then we can write down all monomials in quasi polynomial time, because there are only R variables. There's only logarithmic number of variables. So this is the basic idea. So I want have time to talk about general case, it's proven by induction. We start with a circuit with K multiplication gates, and we find somehow a subcircuit on which we can use the inductive hypothesis. So just show you the graphics. It's not really nice. So I didn't do it. I mean, okay. So okay. So if the if you have more, if you have k multiplication gates, if the top failing is k, we can bound the rank with log d to the power k minus 2. This is in previous slide. But we get a bound which is polylogarithmic instead of log d, which we had in the case of three multiplication gates. Now we have log d to the power k minus 2. So now we can prove the following. I skipped some of the definitions, but maybe it wasn't a good idea. Not sure how much time I have. So we started a bit late, but I don't want to take the time from Sergei. So if we need to finish at 5, I'll just.
So maybe another 5 minutes.
Okay, sure. So let's talk about the problems. Okay, so the identity testing algorithm for the general case is the same. We just compute the rank. If the rank is high, we say it's not zero. If the rank is small, we do a brute force algorithm. So just another case which is interesting, the multilinear case. And it's interesting because there are very strong law bounds in this case. So we would hope for something better. There are actually exponential law bounds for this multilinear bounded circuit. It's not published yet, but one was exponential law bounds, which he said I can quote. I checked. Okay, so what happens if C is multilinear? So every multiplication gate, if you look at these linear functions, they have this joint support, because we can't multiply a variable with itself. So if you look at just one gate, just the linear functions at the first gate, they have rank D. And the rank of the circuit is should be at least D. So what does this mean? We proved that if C is zero, and the definition of simple and minimal, which I didn't say, we show that if C is zero, then the rank is small. So how can these two things happen at the same time? So, right, so we get that D is at most polylog D. So there's only finitely many values of D for which we have these identities, which are multilinear. So, right, so if you want an identity which is a depth three circuit and it's only and it's also multilinear, then the degree is going to be constant. So very limited class of identities. And if we use this intuition, we get that we get a polynomial time algorithm for the multilinear case. Okay, so the open problems are pretty obvious. We can look at identity testing for depth three circuits, and without the restriction on the top Fermion, and we can also look at bounded depth circuits, which I think is like the two obvious steps to take. And of course, the multilinear case looks much easier because there are more things we can say about this model. Really, you understand it better because we have this really strong law bounds. So I think that depth three multilinear circuits shouldn't be too hard for model to work in. And of course, we can also look at the tightness of the result. So we could conjecture that if a circuit is zero, and again, it's simple and minimal, I didn't define, then the rank would be would depend only on the number of multiplication gates and not on the degree. But again, very recently, Karin Saxena showed that this is not this conjecture we had in the original paper is not true. So they give this very nice example. They give it about GF2, but it's also so for finite fields, this conjecture is not true because the circuit for the top top finite tree, and the rank is exactly what we put, it's log d. But maybe for infinite fields this is still true, we don't know. Okay, so